It was very good. How's the fight going? This is by way of an opening gambit now. How is the fight going? Well, you know what the fight. I'm talking about the fight of life. The fight against the elements, against time, against your own increasing inability to cope, against your bad knee. How is the fight going? Is it going okay? It's going pretty good, huh? Well, it's only the middle of the week yet. We've got a long ways to go, or at least we like to presume that we've got a long ways to go, unless out of the thundercloud up there, a gigantic mailed fist comes whistling one down. One day, boom, no Manhattan. Boom, no Bronx. The day the fist squashed Bronx. The Bronx. Yes, that would make a great TV show. Let David Susskind handle that one. A lot of wonderful production effects. We get Vera Garson to play the lady living over in Staten Island who is looking very worried over to Manhattan and sees it's just a big hole in the sea where it used to be, and her husband isn't coming back from the agent. Oh, I got the whole scene, you know. She waits eternally as each Staten Island ferry approaches and there's nobody to take back to Manhattan. You know, oh, it's a terrible set. Mrs. Miniver all over again. Well, how is the fight going, friends? Your own little secret protest that's going on inside of you. You know the little protest that you've got in there. You know what I'm talking about. Of course, everyone knows what I'm talking about. Of course, there's no question about it, but today the protest is a way of life. I suspect in the end that there will be I believe before the year is out, a publisher is going to bring out a guide to the protester. The all-purpose guide. just an idea, you know. Protesting made easy. Or the armchair protester. That would be written by, say, somebody who writes for Harper's. You know, friendly. they're peripatetic protester. And then there will be one called the dynamic protester. And, of course, some religious figure has to write one, too. That'll come along. Or the power of positive protesting. Or peace of mind through sign writing and carrying around and yelling, fist fighting. It's got to come. Did you see, you know, speaking of that, and of course everybody's getting mad, thinking that I am for the causes, that the terrible things that people are protesting against. You know, I have a feeling, if I may interject a feeling here, I know that can be very embarrassing, that most of the things we are protesting against today, in general, our human nature itself. In other words, we're protesting against human nature. We're mad at being people. Now, most protests are leveled against other people. Very few people protest against themselves. So if you can find the flaw in other people that has somehow bugged you a little bit in yourself, protest madly against the other guy and no one will notice you. Now, this is an old forensic trick. It's an old trick that politicians use often. Believe me, the politician with the biggest fist in the till is the first politician to campaign loudly and trumpet loudly. I am going to rout the grafters out of the city hall. We're going to do away with wasteful pork barrel spending. And of course, you see the other guy. Be careful of that. Now, this is the problem with the protesters. Now, most protesters I've known, and I've known protesters all of my life and have from time to time been one, most protesters are blessed with a sense of righteousness far and above and beyond the call of ordinary righteousness duty of the ordinary citizen. Now, by righteousness, I mean a sense that they are intrinsically better and more superior people. they're more sensitive. They have greater morals. No question about that. And they have a firmer grasp of the issues. No question about that. Although most of them don't even bother to read about the issues. They have a firm grasp of their side of the issue is really what it is. And even that may not be so very firm. It's at least very loud. And usually the protester will pride himself on being more intellectual than other people. This is one of the... I've rarely met a protester who would not pretend to be more intellectual, at least more... delving and probing than other people. Oh, yes, I've rarely met one that did not say that. And yet, I have rarely met a protester who was intellectual in any sense. Every protester I've ever met really is usually he's the opposite of intellectual. He is generally a totally passionate person. Most people today confuse passion for intellect. There are diametric ends of the pole. Now, you can be intellectually passionate, or you can be passionately intellectual. But it's very difficult to be intellectual and passionate at the same time. They hardly ever go in the same direction. Oh, yes. And it's hard. And the intellectual is usually really, really mad. It really causes the protester to become angry. Usually, the real enemy is the intellectual, primarily because the intellectual keeps bringing logic into various issues. And they'll say, "What do you mean, logic? What do you got? What has anyone? Who?" And the next thing you know, they're throwing catchphrases like love at you. What is it? Don't you have any love for your fellow man? I said, "Well, I'm not. It's not the discussion of love here. We're talking about the basic issue of right and wrong and logic. The illogical extension of your principle will lead us eventually to an enormous protest that could go on forever and ever. Which, by the way, eventually results in the final protest." You're aware, of course, that the final protest is always war. That's the eventual protest march. And can be interesting. Now, here, for example, did you read in the Sunday Times? One of the things I really dig the Times about is the Times carries pieces that probably inadvertently in many cases, because, and again, maybe not. But they carry pieces that really are truly significant, as opposed to the trivial little news items about this guy's making a speech about this fare rise, and this guy's making a speech about whether the theaters are going to close at 7:30. You know, the big headline stuff in most of the other showbiz papers. But little pieces. And here's a piece I'm going to read to you. It's got a byline. It's from the sport page. Now, you don't expect to find demonstrator news on the sport page, although this insanity out at Roosevelt Raceway is a good example of that kind of thinking that is rampant in the world today. If you don't like what the ruling is, kill somebody. Kill everybody. You don't change the rule. You don't worry about rules at all. You just start burning stuff. And in our world, did you see some of the descriptions of that thing out there, how the people in the stands cheered them? When they were on their rampage burning things, even people who had no money in the race, they were just cheering the protest. That is another one of the assumptions that is very questionable today, and that is that a protester is right. We assume that every protester is right because he's protesting. And one of the fascinating problems with protesters, of course, in general, is that they will use very devious kinds of arguments. Now, for example, in the recent, there's a recent issue of a magazine, I believe it's Playboy, in which Lenny Bruce is quoted. And now there's a typical example of a protester, a free-form protester of our time. And Bruce is quoted as saying, "Well, yes," I would hire convicts. Jimmy Hoffa hires convicts. Yes, I'm for Jimmy Hoffa because he hires convicts. And I suspect that's what Christ would do too. Well, now, you see, this sounds great, you see, because he's brought in the name of a revered religious figure. And he's paralleled it in a very interesting way, never realizing or never wanting to admit that the reason why Christ, we'll say, would hire a convict is a very different reason why, say, Hoffa would hire one. One out of a spirit of forgiveness, the other out of a very interesting, different spirit. And yet this is the kind of argument that is constantly popping up in the world of the protest. Now, I would like to read to you a little piece that you might have missed, and it's a fascinating piece and shows one of the trends of our time. It's on 2S, the second page of the sports section, the Sunday, November 10th issue of the Times. I read. It's datelined Chicago, November 9th. And the man who wrote it, and it's a well-written piece, is a man named Austin Wehrwein. Chicago, November 9th, special to the New York Times. University of Chicago officials viewed with Olympian detachment and some amusement today student protests against small-time revival of football on the Midway. Robert Hutchins, then chancellor, abolished intercollegiate football at Chicago in 1939 after a series of disastrous losing seasons. I'll tell you a little story about that after the piece. Starting about 3 years ago, however, the university has been bringing back football in the guise of physical education. It's called a football class. Yesterday, history of a sort was made when, perhaps for the first time, a game was delayed when students staged a 90-minute sit-down on the 50-yard stripe at Stagg Field. The action delayed the game with North Central College of suburban Naperville. Now, I'm going to tell you about North Central College. North Central College is smaller than most small high schools in this area. And a game with North Central College would be roughly the equivalent of a game between, the Teaneck Little League, roughly, and let's say the Staten Island Little League champs. That would be roughly the kind of game that you've got going there. So don't think that they're protesting against, Big Ten or Ivy League football. This is a very little thing. You have to know between the lines what's going on if you know North Central. The anti-football students carried signs, some of them in Greek, of course, saying, "Ban the ball!" A counter-demonstration on the sidelines saw students with signs saying, "Football, see! Oddballs, no!" The game, the last of four of the football class, has played this year. They had four games, the football class, finally continued after five students have been bundled into the paddy wagon and driven out of the stadium. They were released a block away. Earlier, a student council had passed a resolution expressing apprehension that the football class was the beginning of a revival of big-time intercollegiate football. The council opposed it. The faculty, however, assured the student leaders that such a step was, in fact, absolutely impossible. Walter Haas, the university athletic director, took over the stadium's loudspeaker system to hold a discussion with the demonstrators. "I must object to the absolute insolence of you using our field," he said. "I hope they realize that the image of the university they're so concerned about has not been helped this afternoon," he said to the students. James Newman, the assistant dean of students, used an approach that would have warmed the heart of Dr. Hutchins. "You have made your point," he said into the loudspeaker. "I think you're getting away from the spirit of the university, all kinds of people living together." Warner Wick, the dean of students, said, and here's probably the best point of all, he said, "Now you people, you fundamentalists, who are also dogmatists, why don't you let some other people play and have their fun?" It's a good question. And these people, by the way, I'm sure all pride themselves on one thing. They're for freedom, like mad. But they're sure not for freedom for about six guys to throw a football around against North Central College. Not that kind of freedom. That's a very interesting point. Most demonstrators I know are quite the opposite of open people. They're very intolerant. And this is a very interesting point he makes here. And by the way, I'm not making a plea here for big-time football at all. I'm making a point here that these people obviously were protesting against something that other people were doing, and it sounds extremely harmless to me playing North Central. Anyway, when play finally started, the quarters were shortened because of the approaching darkness. The final score, North Central 7, University of Chicago 6. Boy, if that isn't in the tradition of the university, and they call it playing football, you know. About 2,000 spectators saw the game after the field had been cleared. The loss was the third in four games this season for Chicago and ended the semester. All games were played against junior varsity players from other schools. The Chicago players earned academic credit in physical ed for their efforts. The university stopped football in 1939. It dropped out of other Big Ten competition following the 46th season. The Maroons had played intercollegiate football since 1896 and were famous back in the days of Amos Stagg, the grandest of the old men of football. Speaking of tolerance, this is WORAM at FM New York. Now the point here, before we go on, let's get the business out of the way here, Eddie. Go ahead, hit it there, man. Bum, 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 bum.
Everybody, out of the rut. The 64 Buicks are here.
Oh, what a letdown.
The new Buick Special.
Oh, what a letdown.
Family fun car.
The family fun car.
Buick Skylark, so very personal. The new 64 LeSabre, full size, full of action.
Wildcat. Run out of town,
the red hot Buick Wildcat.
Wow. Great Scott.
The luxurious Electra 225 by Buick.
Oh, wowie.
And the 1964 Riviera, pure adventure.
See these six great cars at your quality Buick dealer now.
Oh, boy. Oh, wow.
Above all, they're Buicks.
Ooh. Excuse me. Boy. Let's see. We have the Christmas fund here. Send your contribution this year to Box 710, Times Square Station, NY. Now, this whole thing of the demonstrators, a way of life today. And again, you know, it's funny that in our time, maybe it's part of the demonstration way of life. But in our day, you have to always rush forward and say that many of the causes that people are demonstrating for, the speaker is for. However, it is getting to the point now where demonstration has almost in many ways superseded discussion in many areas. Now, it is, you know, it's funny. I think most demonstrations start out good and wind up something else. Eventually, historically, this has been a problem for centuries. And this thing about the University of Chicago, I think, is very intriguing because the University of Chicago, you see, is a special university. I don't know whether you know much about it, but the University of Chicago for a long time has prided itself on being an exceedingly intellectual, freedom-loving atmosphere. Now, I believe that most giant fistfights generally start in the name of freedom. I'm sure that the students, the kids out there on the field demonstrating against the football playing, if each one is cornered, would be almost a wild-eyed man in favor of freedom. And then on the other hand, you see, if you were to ask him about the freedom of this little class to play football, obviously it's not going to become the university, it's not going to become Notre Dame, or it's not going to become Army, it's not going to become Pitt, you know, it's not going to become a big deal. Not playing North Central, they ain't, I can tell you that. Four games that they lose, I can assure you of that. They would give you some mumbo jumbo about that it's killing the image of the university and so on. Well, you know, I found this as a man who at one time engaged a little bit in athletics. I have found, strangely enough, it's a hard thing to have to come to some of these realizations, but in general, I have found non-athletic people far more anti-athletic than athletic people are anti-intellectual. Now, I don't know quite why this is. Well, I could give you a lot of reasons possibly why it is. I think part of it is a deep-seated sense of envy. I think this comes partly into it. A very deep-seated sense that is hardly ever admitted to. But I have found often in my experience that, and of course another thing that has to be said about the athletes at the University of Chicago, if you can call them that, in the football class. The University of Chicago has extremely high standards. Standards scholastically, it is a difficult university to get into. The university has high standards in its classes. And obviously, the students who are playing football have to maintain exactly the same level academically as the demonstrators. In short, it is a good student demonstrating against a good student here. Now, the thing that is always assumed, of course, if you're a good student, you are unable to kick a football. That is always assumed. That's one of the great myths of our world. That you see this in the New Yorker, you see this in many magazines constantly, the belief that because a man cannot open the door of his car without getting his thumb caught, that somehow attests to his intellectuality. Thurber represented this beautifully. Thurber was always forever writing articles on how he couldn't drive a car. E.B. White writes articles that have this little slant to them, too. Even Updike occasionally is tinged by that. And you wonder how a man who is so intellectual can't learn how to operate a gear shift. know, you wonder how a man who has such great insight into things cannot back a car up. You wonder what these pure little motor facilities seem to elude these people. But nevertheless, the assumption that is always made is, of course, that the intellectual, and I don't know how to call them, what is the phrase, is a man who uses ideas and who is concerned with abstractions, is this an intellectual? Well, in that case, then I guess I'm one. Then here I am every night. I'm concerned with abstractions and ideas, however imperfect. And yet I have never prided myself that I wasn't very good at throwing the third. It's somehow that the two don't seem to have any connection. And yet, nevertheless, it is always made. And the problem here, of course, is, again, it's a kind of intolerance. It's a new kind of intolerance that is marching under the banner of tolerance. It is intellectuality marching under the... It's truly anti-intellectuality marching under the banner of intellectuality. This is a thing that bothers me. And so today, the man with anger is somehow considered the man who is right. Anger somehow gives a man right today. And so many an author is having trouble, whether you know it or not, many an author today is having trouble that he's not angry enough. And he feels that he's missing the boat because he can't become angry. The more you know about situations, the less possible it is to be angry, in a sense. Very difficult. And so now we've come into a day when there is a new kind of, demagogue around. I don't think that the demagogues today are politicians anymore. I think a politician who tries demagoguery is, in general, in trouble today. I suspect, however, that the demagoguery is coming from the literary world. It's also coming from the protest world. And since a man has anger on his side, we often will pay him obeisance. It's intriguing. I watched a big labor leader being interviewed Sunday on television. It was a sad exhibition. The poor interviewer, who was obviously a man of right thinking, he was a man of consideration, he was a man who believed in discussing issues. He was suddenly up against a man who was a bull of a man. He never discussed issues at all. He would shout the poor little interviewer down, and in addition to that, not only would he shout him down, he would always evade the issue. Always evade the issue by bringing up an extraneous issue and yelling real loudly into the camera until finally the poor little guy was defeated and he wound up looking like a fool. And what is intriguing is, of course, the fact that this man, the labor leader in question, recognized the fact, maybe subconsciously, that the man with righteous anger is always the man to whom everyone will listen. And so the poor little professor would ask a question like, "Well, now what about this thing? You said if I had some flamethrowers, I'd blow up the whole world. That's what I do. Now you said that in 19." All right. I'm glad you brought that up. What about the sharecroppers? What about them sharecroppers down there? Poor little people sitting around without even a loaf of bread to eat. Yeah. I suppose you're... Who said that? When? Wow, who? And the poor guy is sitting there. Pretty soon he's crawling on the floor. The one thing that a demonstration always does, it kills all argument. And this dialogue on the television show was an example of a demonstrator in action. That he was not about to argue any of the issues. He would always answer a charge with a counter charge. He would never answer a charge at all, which is a very interesting problem. This you see on the part of most demonstrators today, that it is hard to. And by the way, I have to give you my credentials. I have been in several marches, so don't immediately write me and say I have no concern for human problems. I do. I think one of the greatest human problems today, though, is the growing dissatisfaction with life itself and pretending somehow, being able to make your mind believe it, that life, that the problems in life are the result of other people's rottenness. And so people with sexual problems, people with all sorts of disappointments in life, which are endemic to life itself. It's part of life. That's just the way life is. These people will, in general, be the most violent and most bitter and vitriolic demonstrators. This is a serious question. The question is, what is life? What is life? Can it be all straightened out? Yes, a lot of people believe it can be. That's what bothers me. A lot of people believe that all the problems can be straightened out. His own combativeness, he never refers to his combativeness. He calls it passion. When he sees it in other people, it's just aggression, just rotten aggression. And so down the line, you see people using the very traits in themselves to fight against those traits in others. It's an intriguing situation. I saw the other day, for example, in one of the newspapers here in New York, at the Village Voice, there was a discussion with somebody, and it was about the closing of a theater. There was a lot of yelling and hollering. There were back taxes, $40,000 or something, and rents and so on. Big closing. And so the tax officials came, and they had obviously been given orders to close the building. So the owner of the theater screamed something at the tax officials to the effect that, well, you can't use the fact that you're just working for the government. You can't use that argument anymore. Not since Eichmann. Very interestingly, paralleling Eichmann with a man doing a job in a tiny way and had very little to do with the burning of 6 million people over a long planned campaign of burning people and one thing and another. And this is what I mean by demagoguery of the other side. It's interesting that most of the people who are the, I think that most of the right thinkers in the world, now using the term right thinkers, and this is a very loose definition, the people who are humanists, generally like to believe that demagoguery is a product of the other side. And yet, the demagoguery of their side is generally so all-inclusive and so wildly inclusive that it makes the demagoguery of the far right look like child's play in many cases. And again, it probably will sound like I'm right-wing here, which is ridiculous. I'm just talking about demagoguery on both sides, but the more subtle kind of demagoguery today is the moral demagoguery, which is very intriguing. The moral demagoguery is the kind of demagoguery which states roughly this: I am a more moral person than you. And since I am a more moral person than you, all of my thoughts are more moral than you. And because all of my thoughts are more moral than you, I am right. One does not have to listen to an immoral person. This is a very intriguing kind of demagoguery. And yet it is popping up all over the place. Today it doesn't seem peculiar today that we will sit and listen to hour after hour on television shows. You see, this is a problem with satire. Now, getting into the subject of satire here briefly for a moment, because satire is a form of protest. Satire today usually takes the form of complaining about other people's specific idiocies, and it is called satire. I would like to point out there's a big difference between satire and polemics. What is generally the work of the polemicist or the vituperist is today called satire. Now, Jonathan Swift, for example, was a satirist. Swift talked about all men's foibles, including Jonathan Swift. Now, he was talking about mankind. He was not talking about a specific politician. This idiot did this week. This insanity went on this week. This went on this week. This went on this week. In other words, it's this is the week that was syndrome. You know what I mean by that? That's the TV show. That what passes for satire is really, in a sense, political cartooning. It is a kind of vituperation. It can be very funny, but is generally very, very dishonest. Because the one-line gag does not do, it does not admit to any kind of extenuating circumstances. nor does it tell you the whole story in any sense of the word. It's very easy to make anybody look ridiculous by taking one line out of context, or taking an action which seems to be illogical, out of context. Very easy to do that. It always reminds me of people who are continually, arguing as to whether or not, let's say, the bomb should have been dropped in 1945. I'm not here to discuss whether it should have been or not. However, they almost invariably take it out of context of a war. They do. They do not argue in context with a war and the conditions that are pertaining thereto. This is the kind of... and again, I'm not saying it should have been. I'm just saying, yes, there's arguments on both sides. But in general, the argument is usually taken out of context, as though it is a quiet, peacetime, can be a long-considered moral consideration. And usually they also ignore Pearl Harbor, too. Again, taking it out of context. But these problems... These problems are getting more and more prevalent in our time. Not just to one area of existence, not just to the political man. Yesterday's example out of the Roosevelt Raceway was a little different than usual riots, you know. Sure, there's always been riots in times in man's struggles. But the kind of riot yesterday was very different from the kind of riots that we have been having for a long, long time. This kind of riot is almost the kind of riot that the Ku Klux Klanners, for example, will partake in, you know? The night riders who burn because they do not like a law or an attitude. They're not going to worry about changing the law. They're not going to worry about discussing the law. They're going to worry about burning. That somehow will take care of it. And you know this, I'm not the only one. A kid, here's an interesting letter from a high school kid. And I'd like to read what this kid thinks of it. Very interesting letter here. He says, on the subject of protest and protesting in general today, I agree with you that it is becoming a way of life. I'm reading the letter, of course. He says, most guys that I know like a protest meeting mostly for the hollering and the fist fights that go on, regardless of what they say about it. I propose, therefore, a TV show that will be the hit of the nation. It will be incorporated with Hootenanny, probably, and will last about 3 hours. The name, well, I'm not quite clear on it yet, but it should be something like Protest Along With Us, or Let's Protest. Every week, a top national protest figure will MC it. For example, one week you could have Peter, Paul, and Mary, then you have Bob Dylan, you have Lenny Bruce. You could have songs of protest and discussion on various issues, and then in the second year, you could change the format slightly, and instead of one MC, you could have a tryst of protesters. Say, Norman Mailer, Malcolm X. You got three or four guys and do a round table, you see, with the singing and so forth. Then you could have Robert Kennedy, Jimmy Hoffa, and Joseph Vallaki the next week, big protesters of our time. And then, of course, you'd have the singers. And then around about the third year, when you're really swinging, you bring out the Protester's Handbook. He says, Protester's Handbook, which is a very good idea. And it contains, it's like a fan mag. It contains information and pictures on protests going on all over the world and gives you 50 beautiful one-line jibes on any given protest issue that will make you the hit or the top sick comic of your office. Well, now, I'm afraid that what has become of so much of what used to be serious, thoughtful discussion of issues that face all of us, what has become of these this area of life has, in a way, been subordinated to and become part of the general area of showbiz, the bit. Unfortunately, today a young man can become nationally famous by latching on to the protest bit, whatever he happens to latch on to, the protest bit. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that he has to have any ideas about it. Usually the ideas are exceedingly banal. For example, segregation is wrong. And this is a very, very profound idea. One that has not occurred to many people. And yet, a guy can make a whole big career on saying that. Or his the next big protest is, war is rotten. Well, I know, son. This has been said by several people before you. It goes back to even the pre-Grecian days, and no question about that. But the discovery that war is rotten seems to be a new discovery with people continually, as though they are going to lead this big fight and bring it out. By the way, usually creating another war. That's the way the fight is usually led. Now, it is too easy today, and I speak as a man working mass media, whatever, mass mediums. It is too easy today to amass a very general, big following and a great big name. Now, I'm not ascribing to many of the protest leaders ulterior motives, except that what generally happens, very funny thing happens to a man. He starts out angry about something. He really is, you know. And he's really mad. You know, he's sitting there, boy, I'm really mad about this. Gee, I'm really sore about it. And he walks around, he talks to a few people about it, and he's really mad. And this is the pure stage. And this is the stage that we generally think pertains forever, but it does not. He says, boy, I'm really bugged. And the next thing that happens is that somebody says, well, Charlie, you know, you're saying some very funny things about that. Why don't you go down to Harold's Friendly Tavern on the corner, and when the jukebox is turned off, why don't you get up on the stage and tell those things to the people? 4 weeks later, the guy is on the Ed Sullivan Show. And he's got an LP out. And he's got the agents calling up. He's got the press relations going. He's got the PR men. He's got the bookings. And it's called Charlie Chowderhead at Carnegie Hall. An angry night with an angry man. And he's working the bit, going left and right. And he goes back and forth. Of course, the assumption is always made on the part of the people who are watching him that he is still angry. Well, that's a very hard question to know whether or not it is true. Now, many of the young men are very angry because they haven't made it. This seems to give them anger. It seems to show anger about the right things and the right problems. But the difficulty arises here when you begin to make human problems, show business bits, you have then reduced the reality of the problem. That large numbers of people sitting in Carnegie Hall listening to a sick comic make remarks about the race relations have the feeling when they leave that they have done something constructive about race relations. And of course they haven't learned anything in that evening. All the things that are said and all the things that they hear are things that they've already known and they already believe it. And they feel this way. But nevertheless, there is a feeling that they have done something really definite about it. And so they go home and they buy the LP of the evening at Carnegie Hall and they play it for their friends once in a while. And they feel that by reading the right magazines, digging the right comics, buying the right LPs with the right folk singers, they have made a definite contribution and a statement about the world. Now, on the other hand, the singers do too, which is intriguing. Most of the singers, you see, who generally they work just like every other singer. They make high fees. They charge real big fees to go to the places they go, and they make the LPs and so on. They feel that by making an LP, they themselves have done a big contribution. It's an interesting question here today, as to where the reality of a protest begins and where the showbiz aspect of a protest takes over. Where does tolerance begin, and where does intolerance begin to march in the shoes of tolerance? Curious about that little football incident. And again, I'm not making a statement here in favor of athletics. I'm merely making a statement that implies that all demonstrators are not necessarily correct. Nor are all demonstrators necessarily right in demonstrating. The principle of demonstration if carried. You know, I suppose in the end, since we are becoming very irritated with being man, I suppose it all started with Freud, when Freud began to discover what mankind was, and we didn't like it. And it's been going on ever since. Kinsey made a few discoveries about man is and does, particularly in the sexual area. Everybody protested about that. And so eventually today we have arrived at the point now where we're protesting against being what literally we are, whether we like it or not. And slowly the evolution goes on. And yet this protest takes the form of some rather interesting byproducts. Most of the people I know who are really deeply concerned over the various big issues of our time, or at least think they are, or maintain they are in an odd way, how shall I put this? In an odd way, the least digging crowd I know. In short, they rarely dig life. They do not like life. Life is a drag to many of them. In fact, there is a whole area of them who will put their they will put their reputation for hipness on the line by telling you how many attempted suicides they have attempted. And they will say, look, there's a guy that tried it four times. Well, he is a four striper. And the chick next to him is only a three striper, but I understand she's going to plan something big for Monday with the oven. You know, this is the truth, you see. And then the same people, on the other hand, will turn to you and look you right in the eye and talk about some poor little clown out in Darien and say, that man is dead. He does not know how to live. He does not know how to live. It's a wildly interesting dichotomy. Very intriguing problem here. And again, this is not an advocate of Darienism. I couldn't make that scene for 30 seconds. But then the gas oven scene I couldn't make either. Sometimes you have the feeling that you're living in a world that's full of madmen on both sides. You know? It's like trying to raise your hand and say to somebody, but look, a tax collector is not the same as Eichmann, friend. And then you have to turn around and you have to say to Barry Goldwater, but Barry Goldwater, individualism also involves responsibility for us. No. And so you wind up trying to wonder where it's all going to stop. Or if it ever will. Again, I don't want to become a protester against mankind. So in the end, you finally wind up just sitting back and picking it like grapes. You laugh on one side, you laugh on the other. And it is as H.L. Mencken said. H.L. Mencken wrote a letter one time to F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Fitzgerald was hung up in Paris, and he was living there in Paris and drinking himself to death. And Mencken says, I don't know how you can do that. He says, you are missing the greatest circus in the world. Speaking of guys who dug life, Mencken was one. He says, you are missing the greatest circus in the world. He says, get out of it, man. Come on back and look around. It's going on everywhere. The circus is going on. The bears are in one ring. The clowns are in another. There goes the guy up. He's going to swing by his teeth from the high wire. Look at that chick working with the hoops there. Look at those Indian clubs. Protest, man, swing and go. The greatest circus on the face of the globe.